Welcome to the home of Blood, Sweat, and Words, a podcast that empowers writers. My name is Joanne Carson. I'm a fiction and nonfiction author, blogger, and podcaster, and I'm trying to make sense of the writing world today. My weekly show is current, relevant, and above all, honest. Join me, and we'll talk it to the bone. That's what Blood, Sweat, and Words is all about. Welcome to episode 12 on Blood, Sweat, and Words. And today I'm talking with S.G. Wong about the marginalization of minorities in books. Let me tell you a little bit about her. Hybrid author S.G. Wong, who I'm going to be calling Sandra, is a member of the Writers Union of Canada, the Writers Guild of Alberta, and the past president of Sisters in Crime Canada West. She writes alternate history, speculative fiction. Sandra is a remarkable speaker. I met her at a Sisters in Crime conference where she spoke about making book marketing manageable, and she actually made it understandable, which is quite the feat. Today we're going to talk about the hot topic, though, of marginalization of minorities. Hi, Sandra.
Hi, Joanne. How are you?
Great. It's nice and sunny here. How is it where you are?
Oh, I can say the same, which is fabulous.
Let's keep it going.
Right.
Well, on to the core of our subject. I'm not sure how to address this topic to get to the meat of it without sounding ridiculously white and ignorant, so please stop me if I'm heading to hell. In this age of Crazy Rich Asians and Black Panther, some people think writers are doing a better job of creating characters of color. What do you think?
Yeah, this is a hot topic, as we say. So I just want to back up a little bit and actually address something I think might be underpinning this conversation, right? And how you framed it. Okay. For example, the very fact that you call it marginalization of minorities. So since, you know, we're all writers here and words are really important to us, one of the things I want to point out is how many I guess white allies, and I see you as one, Joanne, because you are interested and you're open to this conversation and you want to explore it. So, Indigenous, Black, people of color, we are looking for allies all the time, right? Because it's a systemic situation we find ourselves in as people in everyday life, but also as writers, where we're trying to kind of move against the current of how things have been happening, right, historically. So one of the ways that we address it is through language. So the use of the word minorities, for example, I think I've heard that a lot, and it's usually used by white people to call people who are not white as a category, a group. But I think one of the things that often goes unexamined in the use of that term is it's minor compared to what?
it's marginalizing what? In itself, yeah. Isn't it? Yeah.
Exactly. So it's a minority of people versus, I get it, the majority. But the majority in this country, for example, Canada, or the majority in the United States, or the majority in the UK, or are a different Western European country. But in other parts of the world, like China, for example, a minority would have a totally different meaning. It's a very relative term is what I'm getting to. But it's important for white allies to really take a look at languaging and, where are my assumptions coming from in using a word like minority? So I just wanted to address that first, because as writers, I think we all can relate to language and how it's used.
Absolutely. So, I really get your point that the term itself is marginalizing. But on the other hand, when you look at genre fiction, most of the characters are white.
Exactly.
The majority.
Exactly. That's right. And that speaks to a larger trend too, right? I'm sure that many of your listeners as writers or emerging writers, not yet published writers, all the gamut, that many of your podcast listeners are aware that the publishing industry, you know, the trends in publishing is matches, I guess, our societal circumstances. So a lot of the people in charge, a lot of the so-called gatekeepers, that is editors and agents who say, oh, I think I could publish this, or an agent who says, I think I could sell this, they have often been, traditionally been, and it's changing now very slowly, but traditionally they've been people who are white and who have grown up as the majority. I think I can use that term, right? And so their exposure to cultures and literatures of Indigenous, Black, and people of color, not to mention, you know, LGBTQ, Two-Spirit, etc., has been limited. And so their ability, these gatekeepers' ability to understand, you know, the cultural experiential underpinnings of those stories by traditionally marginalized groups has been very small. Their exposure is so small that it's difficult for them, these gatekeepers, to see, yeah, this is the story that interests me, because they're just not aware of, you know, the background of those stories by traditionally marginalized people. So, you know, that's why they often will pick stories written by authors who happen to be white, because it's recognizable for them, for these gatekeepers. And so then people who are writing traditionally and getting published so far, the vast majority here in Canada and in the States, in the English language, I guess we can say, they are writing about characters that they can relate to, and often that's other white people. So what happens in terms of, you know, problematic representations is when we have oftentimes, you know, white authors who are writing characters who are not white. And that's a huge category, right? Not white, not straight, not heteronormative. Right. And they're not, because they don't have that lived experience of what it's like to live in a society that is majority white and straight, then it's really impossible for those writers to really understand and make and create realistic characters of that mold, if that makes any sense.
Oh, it's really difficult. I can relate completely to what you're saying. Yeah. And yet it's so necessary.
It is. It's necessary for those types of representation to happen. And, you know, you see, I think in the publishing industry, sort of at the forefront of this conversation is the YA and middle grade genre. It's not really a genre, but that segment of our publishing industry, because those are the stories that young children and formative minds are reading, right?
And they gobble it up. Yeah.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. Exactly. So many YA middle grade authors just feel this huge responsibility to represent characters of all different backgrounds, all different appearances, all different abilities and disabilities, all different gender orientations, because they understand that they have this power, right? The mm-hmm. the narratives they're creating and getting published have the power to really affect our future, not just the future of the children and the teenagers reading, but the future for all of us, because young people like that, teenagers and children, they're our future, right?
Oh, yeah. So, storytelling is powerful. Yes.
Yeah. Yeah, so there's, you know, in addition to saying, yes, we need more representation in the narratives that get published, is also, I think, a really important additional aspect, which is we need to see authors being published who are of those communities. Yes. So, for example, if your listeners, if you go onto social media, for example, on Twitter, and you look under the hashtag Own Voices, O-W-N, Voices. That is the movement. That is the movement to say, hey, let's take a look at authors who are writing from their lived experience as a Latina, it could be a Muslim author, it could be a disabled author, et cetera, et cetera, right? That's what the Own Voices movement is about. It's like, let's tell publishing, the industry, with its, you know, traditional gatekeepers, that we as readers and we as industry professionals, we want to hear and read the stories written by people who have the lived experience to write realistic characters in this world. So yeah, it's kind of twofold, right? Yes, we want the authors who are already publishing to recognize that there should be a wider range of representation mm-hmm. of types, characters, and people. Mm-hmm. But we also want to say we want a wider representation in the background, in the author community for people who have traditionally been marginalized, as we've been saying.
Yeah, I'm really tired of reading the token gay friend, and the token this and the token that.
Yeah.
But it's hard to, when you're white and as I am, to create characters who really come to life. So I agree, we really need people of color and people of all different persuasions and interests and ethnical backgrounds to be writing and to be having their stuff out there. But do you have any suggestions for... because a lot of us don't fit those categories. What would you advise us to do to get a better idea of how to create characters that are more believable?
Yeah. I'm often asked this question. You may not be surprised to know. And I always say the same thing, which is it takes a lot of work. Mm-hmm. It really does. So one first step is to do your research. But what that research looks like is actually talking to people in that community. Not because you want to use them as test subjects, because nobody likes that. but because you want to get to know that culture. I mean, and there's nothing wrong with for example, I am Chinese Canadian, but I know zero about the Somali community here in Edmonton, which is where I work and live. Mm-hmm. So what I would do if I wanted to write a Somali character is I would approach the Somali community, the cultural center, and I would say, hi, I'm a writer and I'm interested in exploring whether or not I could write a character of your cultural background. And is there anyone, any elders or anyone that I could speak with? Because I want to do it in a respectful way. And then who knows what would happen? They might say, no, that feels exploitative, and we'd rather have our own community write. And I would back off. Personally, I would just back off.
Right?
Mm-hmm. Or they may say, absolutely, thank you so much for your interest, and here are some people you could talk to. And then I would, interview people and learn cultures and customs. And at the end of the day, I may discover, I really loved and I met these wonderful people, but maybe I'm not the right person to write this character, mm-hmm. then I would back off again. Or I might feel like, okay, I've done all my due diligence. I'm doing all this stuff. I'm going to write this character. So say I take that route mm-hmm. and I write this character as respectfully as I can, avoiding as much appropriation, all the appropriation I think I can avoid. Then after I'm done that, I would definitely need a sensitivity read by someone in that community, if not one or two. Mm-hmm. And I would also not expect them to do it for free because that's like cultural education, I guess, of that kind. Often people will do it for free, but that doesn't mean I should not offer mm-hmm. some kind of compensation. It doesn't have to be monetary. It could be whatever we work out. But I would want that person who's willing to do a sensitivity read for me know that I'm willing to compensate them for their time and efforts. And basically I would ask them to read the manuscript and say, can you let me know any parts where my Somali character is not true to what you understand of your culture, since you have lived experience and I do not. And then I would take those comments and I would have to decide, okay, can I change my manuscript to fit that, what's been told to me, I need to change, or is it too much work for me? And then the next draft, I'd have to decide how I want to deal with that, if that makes any sense.
Oh, totally makes sense. Go ahead.
Just a quick note, too, is oftentimes, if you're working with an editor, you have an agent, you could try and negotiate something on that end with your agent and or editor to say, could I be, recompensed for... if it is a monetary compensation for this sensitivity reader, mm-hmm. you can sometimes work that out, right? That's just logistics. But if I can tell a little anecdote of my own, a few months ago, I did a sensitivity edit on a writer's manuscript where they were using Japanese and Chinese cultural customs and characters. Mm-hmm. And I am ethnically, I'm Chinese, but I have studied Japanese. I lived in Japan for a while. So I did feel like I had a some experience with that. And I also suggested to, this was the publisher who approached me to do the edit. I also suggested to the publisher, you know, I know this other editor, she's Japanese Canadian. I think you should get her also to do the sensitivity because then she can put in the things that I missed about the Japanese cultural stuff. So that was me trying to, you know, help the publisher and the author get the best view of this manuscript. And ultimately, I mean, I had to keep track of my time, right? Because there was I was being compensated, and thank goodness for that, because I spent, I don't know, I spent 13 hours going through this, I think it was only 60,000 word manuscript, and doing full edit, but through the lens of cultural sensitivity.
Right.
So it can take a lot of time is really the point of that anecdote. It can take a lot of time for a sensitivity reader to give you thorough notes. So when I did it, I wanted to give the author a full understanding of why certain elements did not work. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, the author was given the edits, and then the publisher came back to me eventually and said, so this is how the author wants to try and fix the things that you and the other sensitivity reader suggested she fix. What do you think? Do you think that will work? Mm-hmm. And so I was very honest and I said, no, I really don't think that will work. Unfortunately, I don't think that will work because there was just a fundamental cultural background that the author was missing, excuse me. Mm-hmm. It was otherwise, it was a very fun book. I thought it could be really, really great. And at the same time, I was very sad that there wasn't a way that I thought it could work. At the same time, I said to the publisher, ultimately, and this is what I say too when authors, when white authors ask me, so how can I do this properly? Mm-hmm. I say, well, you do your due diligence, you do all the research you can, you do everything that you feel like you can stand behind. Mm-hmm. And ultimately, at the end of the day, if it gets published and people read it, you know there will always be people who are unhappy with the fact that you, a white writer, wrote this character or this story that they thought would have been better served written by a person with that lived experience. There will always be people who won't like that. Yes. So all you can do as the author is to be confident that you did the best you can. And that is totally up to you. Yeah. You're the one who says, okay, I did 20 hours of, you know, interviews. I did this, I did that. It's up to you.
Right.
To say I did, and I'm confident that this is good, that this is, you know, and I've had sensitivity readers and they gave me the okay, and I'm depending on that as well as I'm depending on their opinions as well as how much work I know I put into it, as well as, you know, what my publisher, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So at the end of the day, it's like, what are you comfortable with? And it's going to be different for each person, each writer, each editor, each publisher. So, you know, when you're in the industry, it's more than just yourself as the writer. There's a whole team, right? So
yes.
Even in this aspect of writing, you have to consider, like, what does the whole team feel? Mm-hmm. Is the publisher comfortable putting this work out, knowing that there may be some censure from some corners, right?
Right. Excellent. Yeah. I don't think you could have said it better. You answered all my questions about
really?
It.
Okay.
I think it remains a really difficult thing to do, and yet it's a very necessary thing to do because you can't have you can't create a world where different people don't exist. And
that's right.
But the more we know about those different people, the better story we can create.
Yeah. Yeah. So I mean, I think that you and I had an email exchange about this. Basically where you said, you know, I don't know that I'm going to be able to do this well.
Yeah,
writing,
that's how I feel.
You know, doing this thing. And my reply, and I say this to everyone, is it's not about doing it perfectly, because really that's impossible, right? There's just no such thing.
As a writer, quote you on that one.
Yeah, as a writer, as writers, we know there's no such thing as the perfect book. It's never perfect. But it's really the measure of us as people, really, is how are we going to handle it when we make a mistake, right? So say you do your best as a white author, and you've done all that work, and you've got the support and encouragement of multiple sensitivity readers of that, you know, community, your editors on your side, your agent, your publisher, and everyone's like, this is so great. And then there will be people who say, no, that's actually not. That is not great. And we actually, what you published was not what we thought you were publishing. And this could be from people that you had already engaged and consulted with, right? And they'll say, that's not really what we thought you were doing. And we're actually, we don't support this. So then, you know, we've seen it. Some authors will double down and say, well, that's too bad. I did everything that I thought you wanted me to do, and I'm just going to stand behind it. Okay, that's definitely an option, right? That's if a person feels strongly like they did absolutely do everything, then and that's what they're going to go with. That's what they're going to go with. Another way to deal with it is to say, "Whoa, I need to take another look at this. And can we talk about it? What was it that I made a mistake on, and how can I address this?"
And sometimes, treat it as a learning experience. Yeah.
Exactly. Yep. Yeah. And to keep the lines of communication open, because it's so easy, isn't it, for us to feel defensive because it's our
baby.
Art.
Yeah.
And so we automatically, of course, it's natural. You feel defensive, and you just want to say, no. I did the thing. I didn't make a mistake.
I like this character. I really do.
Yeah. Exactly.
Yeah.
You know, and I have great intentions, but. You know, there's a conversation, too, about intentions versus impact. So I teach my children all the time when they were much, much younger. You know, the older one would smack the younger one by accident because they were roughhousing. And I would, and they would say, well, why do I have to say sorry? I didn't mean it. And I would say, well, it hurts just as much.
Yeah, right. Yeah.
Whether you meant it or not, it hurts just as much. So what you're apologizing for is not that you intended to hurt your younger sibling. What you're apologizing for is that you caused them pain, even though it's inadvertent.
Perfect. Yeah.
And it's the same thing, right?
Yeah,
so if we write a character and it's just not what certain people in that community think is okay, then it is our responsibility, I believe, as writers, as the creators, the artists, to engage with that. I don't think it's okay to just say, well, I did the best I could and that's that. I really think we need to engage with that if we've done that as
keep
artists.
The conversation going.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
You know, with it, with openness, right? Because I see this poster in my children's schools, various schools. It's better to be kind than to be right.
Yes. Yes. It would be a better world if we did that.
Yeah, I'm sorry. As I said that, I'm thinking, oh my God, I just like said a cat poster out loud on a podcast. I don't even know.
That's all right.
I can't believe you did that.
You know, sometimes those little phrases will stick better than long arguments. Yeah. So what are you working on these days?
I am working on a contemporary thriller. So as you mentioned in the intro, I write speculative fiction and alternate history. It's hardboiled detective with ghosts and magic, and there's like a whole world I have with that. But I had an idea last spring in May. It just struck me out of the blue as I was traveling in the Rockies, in the Canadian Rockies. So I'm writing this contemporary thriller kind of set partially in BC, partially in Alberta.
Mm-hmm.
And that's all I'm going to say about it.
Oh, Jesus. I love it.
I don't really like to talk much about works in progress because maybe it's a superstition. I don't want to give away all my mojo.
No, I totally agree. To me, I feel like it jinxes it until it's almost ready to publish, and then I start leaking things.
Yeah.
Yeah. And so what is your latest release?
Well, it was from a couple years ago. So it's book 3 in my novel series. The novel series is called Lola Stark, the Lola Stark novels. Mm-hmm. And the first one was called is called Die on Your Feet. And then the latest one was the third one. It's called Devil Take the Hindmost. So I take the titles from aphorisms. So, you know, the Die on Your Feet one is, the saying is, it is better to die on your feet than to live on your knees. Mm-hmm. And this third book is Every Man for Himself and The Devil Take the Hindmost, which is like, if anyone's seen those like zombie posters, those humorous ones, you don't have to run, be the fastest runner. You just have to be faster than at least one person. Kind of what comes to mind when I hear that saying, Devil Take the Hindmost. But it's book three in the Lola Stark series. That was my latest novel release. And then this year, 2018, which is the year of publishing women, I have two short stories in two separate anthologies.
Congratulations.
Thank you. So that's been fun. I'm feeling a little bit at loose ends because I haven't published a novel recently. So the short stories are kind of, you know, tied me over until I get a novel out of me.
So where can we find you and your books?
Yes, please come to my website, sgwong.com.
That's nice and easy, sgwong.com. So this speculative fiction, alternate history, what draws you to that? What is it about that category and genre that really pulls you?
Right. I am a fan of the kind of classic hard-boiled detective, like Raymond Chandler's iconic Philip Marlowe. Mm-hmm. And yes, I fully agree that his novels are problematic and that character is problematic.
But still, it's a great story.
I'm still a fan. Actually, I should say Megan Abbott wrote this great article a few months ago about this very topic, how, yes, problematic, but yes, we still love it. Mm-hmm. So anyway, I just love the fashion of the 30s. I love that hard-boiled aesthetic.
Yes,
and I also love that like touch of noir where like bad things happen no matter what you do. It's compelling. It's sort of like the way we like to read, you know, crime fiction as a way to sort of exorcise some of our fears, perhaps. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Why serial killer novels are so popular, especially among readers who identify as women. So women readers. Mm-hmm. And like, why is it that we love this serial killer stuff? And not every woman reader does, of course, but it's just the stats apparently show it's very popular amongst women readers. Anyway, that it's a way for us to like... It's like catharsis, right? It's all of our fears. We can read about it and deal with that fear at some level in a safe format, which is just reading.
Yeah. Another thing I like about the noirs is that it's always the rich people that are bad. And there's something compelling about that, you know, that the rich are seen as seedy and not giving back enough. And there's something attractive about that.
There is. Yeah, I think you're right. I grew up, lower middle class. So, yeah. I guess in the popular parlance of today, I'm punching up by writing about, you know, nefarious rich people. I don't know.
So what are you reading these days?
I am actually taking a break from reading fiction at the moment, and I'm reading a book of essays by Ursula K. Le Guin.
Oh.
Yeah. Yeah.
I've read her essays. I've only read her books.
Okay. Well, this is something, let me just see if I can remember the title. It's like...
Was it on writing?
No, it's not. It's like something to do with, No Time to Spare.
Oh.
That's the collection name, No Time to Spare. And it's a collection of essays that she posted on her blog the few years before she passed away.
Well, she certainly writes incredibly well. So I'll have to have a look at that.
Yeah. So it's about the urgency, I think, of the thoughts that were going through her about the world and life and et cetera, et cetera. There's actually a really cute little section on her cat.
So it's not all serious.
No, it's not. And if you're a cat lover, I highly recommend that section.
From the writer of Dune. And do you have a final word for us?
Do I have a final word? Related to our topic, I would say, you know, please listen to writers in those other traditionally historically marginalized communities and what they're saying about representation and inclusion. You know, do some research on what people are thinking and feeling and saying about representation and inclusion, because it's not just enough to include one character each who's non-white or non-straight, etc.
Your token but character, yeah.
Exactly. Let's not indulge in tokenism. Mm-hmm. Let's really explore inclusion, which I like as a term and an idea better mm-hmm. than diversity. Inclusion is much more welcoming.
Oh, I like that. I really like that. So did you have another final word? You said that was on our topic. Did you have a final word generally?
Yeah, generally for writers, experiment. Try things and have fun, because at the end of the day, if you're not having fun writing it, your readers can tell.
Oh, yes. Unfortunately, they can.
Yes.
So we're out of time. I want to thank you, Sandra, for chatting with us. As always, it's a pleasure to talk with you.
Thank you so much, Joanne.
It's been fun. And a reminder to the writers out there, you can find Sandra at sgwong.com, right?
That's right.
And tune in next week for my interview with award-winning multi-published author Sharon Ashwood. I'll be asking her about writing Christmas stories in a dark paranormal universe. Thanks for listening. Now it's your turn. What do you think about today's topic? You can leave comments for me on my website or email me directly. I'd love to hear from you. If you want to know more about me, check out my podcast website, BloodSweatAndWords.com. You can also sign up for my weekly newsletter, which contains writing tips and information about upcoming podcasts. Now, if you really, really enjoyed the show, consider becoming one of my patrons through Patreon and help me pay my podcasting bills. And that's a wrap. I leave you with these wise words spoken by Robin Williams in the Dead Poets Society. We don't read or write poetry because it's cute. We read and write poetry because we are members of the human race, and the human race is filled with passion. And medicine, law, business, engineering, these are noble pursuits and necessary to sustain life. But poetry, beauty, romance, love, these are what we stay alive for. To quote from Whitman, "O me, O life, of the questions of these recurring, of the endless trains of the faithless, of cities filled with the foolish, what good amid these, O me, O life?" Answer, that you are here, that life exists, and identity, and the powerful play goes on, and you may contribute a verse. That the powerful play goes on, and you may contribute a verse. What will your verse be? See you between the lines.